First, I want to thank Naren for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be back after almost 5 years. It's also almost 5 years since I've seen snow in person. So today I'll be talking about this. So this is some work I've been doing with Naren and Mason occasionally at Maryland. So the outline of the talk is I will start giving some introduction and making some general remarks about our approach. Then I will tell you about a scientific example, then a experimental example, and I will end up with a summary of what we've done. Okay. So the general idea is that, you know, when we have symmetries, the classification of phases of matter gets enhanced, so we have more phases because of the presence of symmetry. And in general, you know, if I tell you that my system has some symmetry group G, the kind of questions that I want to ask is how many different phases there are, or also what are the appropriate labels for the phases, you know, what are the invariants that I can compute to tell them apart. Also, I'm interested in, you know, in practice, how do we actually compute the labels? In practice here, I mean either in experiments or in a numerical simulation. Okay, so this is the general kind of things I'm interested in. And but you know, this problem is a bit too general, so I want to make some assumptions to actually try to get some concrete answers. So first of all, we will be mainly working into special dimensions. Then we will restrict us to work on invertible states. So for all purposes, you can think of them as just being ground states of local Hamiltonians that are gapped. And these states are the unique ground states when you put the Hamiltonian on a closed manifold. And here are some examples of states. Okay. And then the other point that I want to make is that, you know, this invertible comes from the fact that when you have some state like this, there is some other state that you call it the inverse, such that when you put them together, you can deform the tensor product to some trivial state using just local manipulations. And the idea is that using that notion of inverse allows you to give the structure of an abelian group to the classification. And then the kind of symmetries that I'm going to be working with are, I'm going to take the symmetry group G to be just a direct product between on-site symmetry and a spatial symmetry. Here K is going to be either U1, SO3, or C2. And G space is going to be our paper group. So in two dimensions, there are 17 such groups, but today I will be mainly focusing on the symmetries relevant for square lattice. But the results that we have in the papers are they apply for all the groups. Okay? And I will sometimes mention what are some differences and what things are the same. Okay. So now that I've told you what are the my assumptions, I'm going to tell you what methods were what we used to try to answer the problem. Okay, so I would say there are these three different approaches that are kind of complementary. Each of them we have its cons and pros, but my point is that I believe we need to use the three of them in combination to get a really good story. So first of all, you have this way of doing things that I'm going to refer as ideal wave functions. And the idea is that you are constructing really simple examples of states that are, ground states of Hamiltonians that have a really simple interpretation in real space. So examples of these are atomic limits, but this is not everything that can happen. Sometimes you need to include things that cannot be taken to be just some simulators, but that's why I'm not talking about zero correlation length states, okay? But in that case, you always have some ideal limit of the wave functions. The issue, like, one issue with this approach is that, in general, if I give you Hamiltonian or a state, it's not a priori clear, like, what is its ideal limit. So this is a drawback. And then the other drawback that I would say is that, in general, you don't know what properties of these ideal states are going to survive when you go away from the ideal limit. Okay, and then there is this other approach that I'm going to be referring to, minimal invariance. And here, what I have in mind is that, again, if I give you a Hamiltonian or a state, I want to compute something from the state. So it could be some expectation value, some correlation function, or it could be what happens if you introduce a symmetry defect to a system. Okay. One issue with this approach is that, in general, you can write down a lot of things. So it's not clear how many invariants you need if you don't use the other two approaches. Then there is also this issue that sometimes you can write a lot of invariants, but they are related to each other by one reason or another. But then one nice thing about this approach is that usually these minimal invariants are sort of easy to evaluate when you work with the ideal wave functions. So this is a nice interplay between these two approaches. And finally, there is this, just a more topological field theory approach, in which, so first of all, because we're dealing with crystalline symmetries, we need to decide how to map this problem to an easier problem, to the problem that we know how to solve. So for this, what we're going to be using is the crystalline equivalence principle that, in essence, is telling us to treat the lattice symmetries as if they were internal symmetries. And then we use well-known techniques to classify systems in the presence of internal symmetries. And in essence, what we're trying to do is given some symmetry G, we're trying to write down the most general action. For bosons, this just ends up being like, in two dimensions, it's just doing the group cohomology calculation. For fermions, it's a bit more complicated, but we know how to do it. One nice thing about this approach is that when you obtain like this action, sometimes it's this. We can relate the coefficients in this action to the minimal invariants that I was talking about. So it, again, this is complementary. And then also, like, from the actions, sometimes we can obtain relations that are not so obvious when you just think about the minimal invariants on their own. And this also gives us an alternative check for what the, say, the ideal wave function approach is complete, in a sense. Okay, so in practice, these approaches, at least in the examples that we've looked at, they give you the same answer. What we're trying to do is we're trying to find enough minimal invariants that are able to detect all the different phases predicted by either this approach or this approach. Okay, that's the general philosophy that we're trying to follow. Before I move on, are there any questions so far?
Actually, up to now, do you have an example where the three don't approach each other?
So the thing is that if you do ideal wave function, you have to be if you're forced to just use states that have zero correlation length, then these two are going to be different.
Yes.
So. Yeah, then I think these two gives you the same answer as far as the examples that I have in mind. For this one, as I said, like, you just need to add look for enough invariants that you can reproduce the other ones. That's the idea. Okay. So the first part of a talk, we're talking about crystalline SPDs for bosons or spins. This is an upcoming work that hopefully will be out soon. She said, in the paper, we're going to have the story for like all the work paper groups, but in this talk, I will be focusing on the case where the special group is P4M. Here, P4M is are the symmetries of the square lattice, and this is generated by translations and rotations by 90 degrees and reflections. Okay. So let me start with just what happens when the classification is, when the symmetry is just the special symmetry. Okay, so before I tell you the answer, let me establish some notation. So here I'm showing you what the what the unit cell of the square lattice is. Alpha, beta, gamma 1, and gamma 2 are points, are the so-called like maximal bake-off positions. These are positions in the unit cell that have a large symmetry group. For example, there is a symmetry group that fixes them that is non-trivial. For example, for alpha, so the point alpha is fixed by rotations around it and also reflections. Similarly for beta and gamma. Then here I'm calling this gamma 1 and gamma 2 because the gamma 1 and gamma 2 are related by a C4 rotation. So even though they are different points, they are related by a symmetry group. So essentially, if I know what's happening at gamma 1, I will know what happens at gamma 2. So that's why you only need, you often only need to keep track of one of the orbit. Okay. In addition to this, these maximal bake-off positions, I'm also labeling in these various orange lines to be, these are like the line version of maximal bake-off positions. So these are lines that are invariant under that are fixed by some reflection. So in this case, again, we have only three orbits, because for example, this lambda one, this horizontal line, is mapped to lambda two, which is a vertical line, and these are again related by C4 rotation around alpha. Okay, so in general, I have three different maximal bake-off positions and three different maximal lines. But for now, I only need to keep track of what happens for the points. Okay, is it clear, the notation? Okay. So in this paper, work by Hermeli, what they found is that the ideal wave function classification tells you that the different ideal wave functions are essentially just atomic insulators that are characterized by what the charge of the stabilizer group at alpha, beta, and gamma are. Okay, so essentially, what you ask is, at alpha, so at alpha you have degrees of freedom that transform under D4, and then you ask, what is the charge under D4? So if you remember your group theory, D4 has five representations. Four of them are one-dimensional, and there is a two-dimensional representation. So here, because we're assuming that there is a unique ground state, we can only have one-dimensional representations at each point. So that's why we only keep track of the 1D representations. And you can show that these representations and their tensor product form this group. And essentially, the way you think about this is that one factor essentially tells you what is the angular momentum under rotation, and the other factor tells you what is the parity under a reflection. Okay, so then you have the same story for beta and gamma 1. For gamma 2, you don't need to keep track of it because, if you know what happens at gamma 1, you can infer what happens at gamma 2. So here, because these groups are not, they are isomorphic, but they are not the same group. these invariants are actually independent. Okay. So putting things together, the full classification is given by this group. Okay. So okay. At this point, I've only told you what is like the ideal wave functions for P4M. So now I want to try to come up with some many more invariants that are able to detect to which of these phases the my state is connected to. So for this, we're going to be using this this method that was proposed by these people over here. The idea is that you take some large region. So you start with the state psi, that it's a ground state on some large, like very large region, and then you take a region R that it's large, but it's not so large compared to the whole system size, to the whole system. And then you take O, which is a symmetry that leaves R invariant. And then what you do is you evaluate this expectation value. So you evaluate the expectation value of O restricted to the region R on the state that you're interested in. The idea here is that you expect this form of the, sorry, when you evaluate this, you expect this because of the following reason. The idea is that when you apply O inside R, just in the bulk of the region R, essentially you're not doing anything because O is symmetry. At most, what you're doing is you're multiplying the wave function here by a phase. Okay, so this is one contribution to this phase here, phi. Outside of the region R, you're not doing you're not doing anything. So again, there's nothing going on around here. All the most violent thing that you're doing is close to the region R, and because you're assuming that psi is gapped, you're kind of assuming that things decay exponentially. So at most, the things will decay exponentially in the system, in the size of this region we are doing like violent things. However, this region, the contribution from the boundary is not just an amplitude. It can also give some contribution to this phase. So the idea is like for this phi, there are going to be two types of contributions, and from phi you will be able to actually figure out. You will be able to extract some invariants. Okay, and then okay. So in general, we expect the expectation value to take this form. But a priori, I cannot guarantee you that this phi is going to be quantized to some value. However, in practice, you can evaluate this, say, for the ideal wave functions, and you find that indeed this phi is going to be quantized. Then you can also use, for example, this a conjecture by Liam and Haldane that tells you that essentially, in order to figure out what's going on with this expectation value, you can treat this as if it was some correlation function for the CFT described by the entanglement spectrum of the state psi, and from there you can also deduce that often that this phi is going to be quantized to some value. Okay. And then finally, just in practice, when we run numerical simulations, we often find that the quantization is quite good. So we take this as evidence that this is actually working. Okay, is the idea that clear about this?
Yeah. So the phi relates it to something like entanglement, some other thing we or like topology entanglement etc.
Well, so I think like entanglement entropy is related to gamma, right?
Uh-huh.
I think this phi, as I said, is something like is the phase that you get from acting on with O inside that region R. So there's one contribution. Another contribution is just from some other phase that that appears when you're computing correction functions in the CFT. I don't think it's necessarily related to like entanglement entropy, but yeah. Okay. Should I move on? Okay. So for the case that we're dealing with P4M, there are going to be two types of invariants that we need to detect all the phases. So first is this partial rotation that was proposed in this work by Chusaki, Shapurian, and Ryu. So what you do is you pick a point O that it's invariant under some rotation, say CM. And what you do is you take some region, some large region R that it's CM symmetric, and then you evaluate the expectation value. And then here I'm omitting the exponential decays. I'm just keeping track of the phase of the leading term. Right. So what you do is the way you extract an invariant here is you identify, you know, here phi, you know, this phi is going to be now 2 pi over m times theta o, and the invariant is just going to be what this theta o is. So for the states that we are looking at, this we find that theta o is going to be evaluated in this theta o is going to be like either an integral from 0 to m. Okay, so this has been known, and the second thing that we need to consider is when we have reflections, we have to be a bit more careful. So initially we thought that you know, if you just have one reflection, you could do something similar to what you do here, but that doesn't quite work. And what we need to do is this only works when you have, say, at around O, you are invariant under D2. Here D2 is the group that is generated by two perpendicular reflections. So here, you know, D2 is generated by reflection around L and around L prime. And the invariant that we propose is we take the region R and we break it apart into three subregions, R1, R2, and R3. And we assume that R1 and R3 are mapped to each other under L prime. That's the type of that's the new invariant that we're proposing. And then what we do is we evaluate this expectation value. We apply the reflection about L restricted to R2, and then we apply the reflection around L prime restricted to R1 and R3. Okay. So the reason why we had to do this is, as I said, like this doesn't quite work if you just have one reflection. And the reason is that, so one reason that I can give you is that in two dimensions, there is no bosonic phase protected by just one reflection. Okay, so that's one indication that, you know, it shouldn't work. And then the other reason is that if you try to evaluate the naive invariant for a couple of for a state that we have later, you just get something that you get zero. So you get something that is not consistent with what we want. So that's kind of the reason why we went to this, you know, a bit more complicated invariant. But yeah, this should work. Yeah, and here just some notation again.
Just make sure. So suppose I have just one reflection and some internal symmetry such that there exists no shape of symmetry, then
you can do something, but I will talk about that later, but it's, you can do something, but it's not, so I think like for that one, you need to consider like twisted boundary conditions. Okay. And then do some partial reflection, but yeah. So like the nice thing about these two is that you can get everything from just one wave function, like without twisting or anything. Yeah, so here, you know, the two invariants that I'm proposing is like this theta that is related to the rotation, that you can think of it as maybe as a angular momentum. And here this sigma OL, so here sigma OL depends on the point and also like on which reflection line, like the first reflection line. And we expect, you know, this is also like, you can think of it as just the parity under that reflection. Okay. And then, right, so, okay. And because you have D2, you can tell a similar story to, you know, if you rotate this by 90 degrees and you get another invariant, you get another C2. But, you know, if the system has C4 symmetry, these two invariants are forced to be equal to each other, but in general, they could give you independent invariants. Then, another point that I want to make is that when you're evaluating when psi is just when you take psi to be just an atomic limit, so meaning that it's just like the tensor product of so psi can be written as a tensor product of states localized at the high symmetry points of a lattice, you can convince yourself that this theta and this sigma, they just you can calculate them by just knowing what happens at all, because anything like any contribution from away from all will cancel in, like in this case in pairs, in this case in like in orbits, so things just cancel out. So yeah, so using this observation, what we propose is that for P4M, these are the complete set of invariants that are able to detect any of the crystalline phases. So let me translate what this means for you. So okay, so before in the ideal wave function case, what I was saying is that essentially the classification is given by what is the angular momentum and the parity around alpha, around beta, and gamma 1. So that translates into, you know, for each of these guys, you have a theta and you have a sigma, okay? And then here I have to divide by 2 because, you know, because alpha has C4 rotation symmetry, so in principle, the angular momentum can take values 0, 1, 2, or 3. However, because you have a reflection line that goes through alpha, you force this angular momentum to be either 0 or 2. That's why we can just divide by 2 and get a C2 valued invariant. The same thing happens for beta, and for gamma, you don't need to do that because gamma is just invariant under C2. And then, and also like from this picture, you can get some relation between other invariants that you would naively think that are independent. So for example, you can try to calculate what sigma alpha of lambda 2 is. But that can be calculated if you know this and this, because, you know, that's essentially, yeah, I think it's going to be just like the sum of these two guys. Okay, so now I'll move on to what the TQFT approach tells us. So in this case, when you do the crystalline equivalence principle, like the only modification that you need to do to the group is to treat reflections as if they were anti-unitary symmetries. That's the main difference. So in this case, for P4M, we need to introduce three different types of gauge fields. So we have a translation gauge field, we have a rotation gauge field, and we have a reflection gauge field. And then using the group cohomology, this is like the general action that we find. Okay, so a couple of observations here. We have 6 different terms, the same as the ideal wave function approach. And another thing that I want to remark here is that this D is not the naive differential that you would write down. You need to twist it, and essentially you need to keep track of you need to keep track of what happens when you have reflection, like reflection fluxes, essentially. Okay. So we have this this action, and from here we can get, we can relate these coefficients here, this k1o, k2o, and so on, to the theta-os from before. Something else that I want to remark here is that it's important that we, that these cage fields are defined with respect to some origin. This is important to actually have to actually be able to compare different systems. And another thing that it's important from there, that you learn from this observation is that, from the observation, you can see the following. So here, this coefficient here, 2k1 times k1o, it should tell you what the angular momentum with respect to like the rotation around o should be. And the idea is that if you just, if you now change your origin to, to a different point, all these coefficients, the coefficients will change. So in general, when you try to compute the angular momentum with respect to some other point, in general, it's not going to be equal to this. It's going to be equal to this plus some combination of the other terms. And from there, that's how we obtain like we relate these coefficients to the various things here, to the theta alpha and so on. Okay. So before I move on, any questions about the case where I'm only considering crystalline symmetries? Should I move on? Okay. Okay. So now I want to ask what happens if, in addition to the well vector group, I add some internal symmetries. And as I said, the kind of symmetry, the groups that I'm going to be focusing on is either U1, corresponding to charge conservation, SO3, spin rotation, and C2. It could be just conservation of particles model 2, say, or a nice symmetry. OK, so let me start with the case of U1. So in this paper by Song, Fang, and Chi, what they found is that for k equal u1, the idea with functions are still atomic limits. And the idea, so they are atomic limits, and the way to differentiate them is by how much charge you have at O. So here O is either alpha, beta, or gamma. And the net charge, it's only kind of well-defined modulo the order of rotation. And the reason for this is that, say, if you are at alpha and you have charge, like 4 units of charge, you can always just move them away from alpha without closing the gap without closing the gap. So that's why the charge is only, it's only kind of well-defined modulo the order of rotation, okay? In addition to this, we also have just the filling per unit cell. So this is just like how much charge you have at a unit cell. So, but one observation here is that if you know what the filling per unit cell is, you can obtain some information about what the net charge is. So that's why the classification ends up being C4 cross C2 cross C. So this C4 corresponds to this Q, like how much charge you have at alpha modulo 4, this C2 corresponds to how much charge you have at gamma 1 modulo 2, and this C is the filling. So then, if you know these three things, you can figure out what the charge at beta modulo 4 is, because any charge that is located away from alpha, beta, or gamma, they always come in pairs of 4. So that's why if they new when you take modulo 4, you know what gamma is. Right. So then, the way we propose to measure this QO is essentially doing partial rotations, but here CM is we need to replace CM by CN times a U1 rotation by an angle of 2 pi over m, essentially. And from there, you can, from the phase that we obtain, then we can extract what the charge is. Okay.
So that theta is different from the.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that we need to replace this CM by CM times a U1 rotation, and this theta is going to be different. And this QO is going to be related to some difference of the two thetas that you get.
Sorry,
something.
Why is there only one theta? Can't I put different charges?
Sorry?
Can I put different charges
in different? Yeah. Right, so I mean, you can put charges at alpha, beta, or gamma.
Yeah.
So you get C4 because you're putting charge. So you can put charge at the asymmetry points, right? So you would naively think that you will get C4 cross C2 cross C4, right?
Why is it? I think the question was that shouldn't the night classification be C times C times C?
Oh, so the issue is that if you have 4 units of charge at alpha, you can move them, you know, you can move them away from alpha. So the point is, so but then you do get a factor of C because the total charge is conserved.
Yeah.
Right. So this is how we propose to extract them. I guess here I want to make one observation because we're working with P4M and we have reflections. Reflections force the whole conductivity to be zero. So if we were to have a state that has like a non-zero Hall conductivity, this relation is not so simple. I will briefly mention more about this when we're dealing with fermions, but. For now, because reflections are present, with this is like very simple, the simple relation that we get. Right. So then, when we write down the action takes the following form. So here, A is the gauge field for the U1 symmetry. And the action for the mixed terms is essentially, you know, you're multiplying A by the curvature of the various gauge fields. And from here, it also gives you a more physical understanding of what the different phases correspond to. For example, this M1O, you know, is a coefficient of A times the omega naught. This is a version of the shift. And what this kind of tells you is that, you know, if you have a rotation defect, how much charge you will be trapped around this defect. Then, for example, this term here, what it tells you, it tells you charge polarization, because yeah, it's charge polarization. And then this last term is A times AXY. This AXY is the area form, so this obviously that tells you the charge per unit cell. Okay, I'm doing some similar manipulations to the ones that I was describing when we have pure crystalline symmetries. We can relate this m, you know, these coefficients here to the coefficients, to the minimally invariance. Any questions about U1? Okay. So the next example I want to consider is what happens when you have SO3 symmetry. So again, in this paper by these people, what they found is that now the ideal wave functions are, they correspond to placing AKLT chains along the high symmetry lines. you can place things around lambda, like lambdas or the news or on news. And right, so yeah, and then because we know that this the one dimensional SPT is protected, but sorry, this AKLT corresponds to the non-trivial one dimensional SPT is protected by SO3, and we know that they are specified by C2, so you get a factor of C2 for each one of lambda mu nu. Okay, and so the thing that the way you can detect these phases, we have a couple of different approaches. So one approach is to use partial reflection with twisted boundary conditions. So what I mean by this is that we place the system on a torus, and then along one cycle we say we consider we impose that when you go around the cycle that is twisted by a pi rotation around say the x-axis inside of SO3, and then you apply, you need to compare what is the expectation value when you are doing just the bare reflection and then the reflection composed with a pi rotation around a different angle. So that's how you can extract an invariant here. But the issue with this is that you need to actually find the ground state with this boundary condition. So the approach that I like more is to use this double partial reflection. And what you do is that instead of evaluating using just the reflection around L and the reflection around L prime, what you do is you use the reflection around L composed with say a rotation around a pi rotation around the x-axis in SO3. And then for L prime, you don't use just the reflection around L prime, you use the reflection around L prime composed with the pi rotation around the perpendicular axis compared to what we use for L. Okay? And the idea here is that so why this detects this phase is because essentially like this the way you characterize this the one-dimensional SO3 SPT is that at the edge you will have a spin 1/2, right? So the idea is that if you act here with a pi rotation around x and here a pi rotation around the c-axis, when you do like the calculation carefully, you find that you end up picking up the anti-commutation between these two internal symmetries acting on this edge. Okay, and then also it's important here to point out that you only care about what's going on in this axis, because anything that any contribution coming away from this axis will cancel in pairs. Okay, so that's why this works.
So, and let me make sure I understand. So to protect this space, it's by only one reflection in this.
Yep.
So the other reflection, everything is really just from.
Yes, it's for convenience. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
If it's not there, can you still do this?
I don't think so, but I haven't thought about that much carefully, but I don't think so. Because usually having like a lot of reflections and rotations helps you make sure that some spurious contributions just cancel. So that's why this works. And then, okay. And then one last thing that I didn't write here, but I want to mention is just that the other things that you can look for is look at the system with open boundary conditions and just look at what the edge what happens at the edge. So for example, these various things will tell you some things about Lipschitz Matisse-like anomalies on the edge. Right. So, for example, you know, say if you have a KLT chain along lambda one, what happens is that you will find a spin 1/2 on like on this like a theory green point on the boundary and so on. So this is another way to characterize these spaces. Yeah. So something that I wanted to mention here, is that even though this, you know, the way I constructed these faces seems to rely a lot on reflections, it's not, you don't need the reflections to protect this. For example, if you break, if you forget about reflections and you only consider before, meaning that you have translations and rotations, this specification doesn't break down completely. You will get C2 cross C2. And one way to see this is from the effective action that I haven't written down. But if you just look at that, you can deduce that, you know, it will just go down to C2 cross C2. And essentially, the different, when you have rotations, something else that you can do is you can evaluate partial rotations, say, around alpha or around beta and so on. So this also tells you that, you know, that if you know this, you know, invariants that are more related to reflections, you can also calculate invariants that are related to rotations. And any questions about SO3? Okay. Then finally.
Some of you can have 15 minutes.
Okay. Then the second example, sorry, the last example that I want to consider for bosons is this thing. So now we have a finite group, like it's C2 symmetry. So this group behaves kind of U1 and kind of SO3. More precisely, what I mean by this is that when you look at what the ideal wave functions that you get, they can be written combining two different types of wave functions. So one is we have atomic insulators that you can think of it as just treating C2 as a subgroup of U1. So essentially, it's you have C2 charges at alpha, beta, or gamma. That's why you get a factor of 3. And then the other case is that you have an AKLT chain along the high symmetry lines. However, in this case, it's a bit it's a bit different. Because you know one-dimensional SPTs, there is no one-dimensional SPT predicted just by C2. You need two C2s. So here the second C2 from the following reason. So say if you are looking at lambda one, you know that if you look at reflection around lambda one, the reflection acts as an on-site symmetry on that line. So that's why. If you look at, say, at this line here, you actually have a C2 cross C2 on-site symmetry. One is this from this K, and the other one is a reflection. And the AKLT is a representative state of this SPT predicted by two C2s. Okay. So putting things together, you find that this is C2 to a 6. And again, you can detect all the different faces using either partial rotations or partial reflections on whatnot. Okay. Any questions about this? Okay. So the story for the general work paper group is that for groups where you have enough rotations, that they deal with functions for the groups that you know, for U1, SO3, or C2, they are still like either atomic insulators or just placing AKLT chains. And you can detect everything using partial symmetry operations. However, this doesn't hold for all of them. Like there are five other groups where you need another kind of invariance that you kind of what you need to do is you need to put the state on tori of different sizes and just look at the L dependence. And this is I think this sometimes is referred to as weak invariance in the literature.
Is that because you don't know how to do partial symmetry transform for translation?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's essentially just the reason. Yeah, so in the paper we give like for our papers we give like the full classification and how things how to understand each factor of the classification and so on. You said I have how much?
Okay.
Let's see. Right. So I guess before I move on. So before I move on, like any questions about the bosonic case? No? Okay. So for fermions, the story is a bit more complicated, essentially because the group homology doesn't give you the correct answer. You need to do something a bit more sophisticated. But in either case, we know how to do it, so we do that. And in particular, and in this work, we focused on orientation preserving groups. So by this, what I mean is you have only translations and rotations. And in this talk, I will be focusing again on the case where we have P4 and U1F. This U1F just means that you need to identify fermion parity with the element, with the pi rotation in set U1. Right? That's what this means. So when we do this, TQFT approach, what we find is that the classification is given by this group. So notice that you have a part that it's just like integers and then some torsion part. The action that we find is this. However, in this case, it's not so easy to tell you, this coefficient is C classified and so on. It's a bit more subtle. And this subtlety comes from the fact that we're dealing with fermions. But in this paper, we have like explicit relation how to relate the coefficients to this invariance. Okay, and then a useful result to know is that in this case, like the ideal wave function that we can take is either atomic insulators or chair insulators. Okay, let me just briefly tell you what the invariant how to understand the invariance. So the integral invariants are sort of easy to understand. So you have C minus over 8 and kappa. So C minus is the Kaya central charge that tells you the difference between right and left movers when you look at a system with open boundary conditions. And then C and kappa are just what appears in the Estrella formula for the filling when you have a uniform magnetic flux to the system. Something
You're saying that your group is G crystal cross U1F.
Yeah.
That by definition has phi equal to pi integer.
Yes. But you can still ask what happens if you add a U1 flux. Okay. So, yeah. So one thing here is I didn't want to mention this, but the point is like if you just do the TQFT calculation, the answer doesn't depend on phi. So if you actually try to compute the group, like the classification for P4, the non-trivial extension of P4 by U1 with magnetic flux, the answer doesn't change, at least like from the approach. So here, one thing to notice that it maybe, for me, was interesting when I learned about this, is that if you know the Kaya central charge, you know this C modulo, the difference between C and C minus is always a multiple of 8, at least for invertible states. Okay, then these other invariants are a bit more. So in order to understand these other invariants, what you need to do is you need to do a fermionic version of partial rotations. Okay, here because you have U1, because you have the U1F, you actually have like spinful rotations and spinless rotations. So this theta plus theta minus essentially corresponds to evaluating the partial rotation for spinful and spinless rotations. And then in the paper, we work out you know, how to relate these to the coefficients. And yeah, also like I think in, I don't remember if it's this paper or this paper, they did like a numerical check for the Hofstadter model. You know, you predict some discrete shift from this theory, and then you can numerically check that, check if that happens. Okay, how much time do we have? Yeah, so the last thing that I wanted to end up with, to tell you about is, you know, about something that, so a map between free fermions and the interacting classification. So the reason why I'm interested in this is that this map can tell you which non-interacting phases can be connected to each other in the presence of interactions. So, you know, yeah, that's my main motivation for this. Let me tell you what the, let me tell you how the non-interacting classification for fermions is understood. So in this case, again, we're dealing with symmetric groups that are U1F cross wood paper symmetry. So in the non-interacting classification, this goes by the name of class A plus wood paper group. And to a large extent, this is well understood, and what you do essentially is you do some computation using the single particle wave functions in momentum space. That's like the main approach. Like, and you know, there are different flavors of this, but the idea is that often you cannot a priori tell if this approach is complete. Usually, you need to do some K-theory calculation to check that, you know, you're actually capturing all the phases. But in a sense, this is similar to, you know, what we were doing. So I would say that the this first approach is kind of doing many more, like a single particle version of many more invariants, and this K theory is kind of doing quantum field theory calculation for like the non-interacting system. Okay. However, it's obvious that when you add interactions, this breaks down because you no longer have single particle wave functions essentially. So. Right, so let me tell you what's the story for P4 at least. So the way you understand the invariants that you calculate for a non-interacting state is the following. So you go to momentum space and you look at how the field state, like the field bands transform under the point group. Okay, and it's a fact that you only need to care about what happens at the high symmetry momentum. Say, you know, for example, you diagonalize your single, like your, you diagonalize the single particle Hamiltonian at gamma, and that, you know, you then look at what is the angular momentum of the field states. And, you know, because we're dealing with P4, you have C4 rotation around gamma. So there are four different representations. Okay. You do similar thing for M and for X. And in addition to that, because we don't have reflections, you can also have a non-trivial Chern number. Okay. And then one point that I want to, sorry. However, not all these quantities are independent, because the idea is that because we're dealing with insulators, the, you know, the number of field bands is constant along the all over the Bloisson. So if you know how many states you have at gamma, it's the same as X and M. So that's why I can get rid of one of the numbers for M and X. However, there is also like another relation that was derived by Bernevik's group, that if you know all these, you know, all these numbers, you can figure out what C is modulo 4. Okay. However, this doesn't affect the classification. The classification is still C2 and 9. So you get an integer for each of these guys. Okay. So now, kind of wanted to answer is, you know, sorry, we wanted to figure out if I tell you what the non-interacting invariants are, can you tell me what the interacting invariants are? And essentially, we found, you know, a concrete nice formula for this. This is just, you know, this is just this matrix. And the way we did that is by essentially we found a convenient basis for the non-interacting states, and these states are, you know, are for them it's easy to evaluate these invariants over here. The only one that we need to do some numerical work was for the Chern, like a Chern insulator with Chern number one, but for all the others, because all the others are just insulators, this thing is fairly easy to calculate. So yeah, this is again just a concrete map that tells you how to go from the, you know, the non-interacting classification that it's C to the 9 to a group that it's, you know, has some C to the 3 times some torsion part. Okay, and we have a similar map for all the orientation preserving groups. Okay, and you know, I'm just going to leave it my summary slash outlook here, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thanks.
Interacting invariants that do not have a free Fermion analog.
What do you mean?
So, suppose you started with a set of interacting invariants, can you always propose some free Fermion invariants?
What do you mean?
Supposing I had an interacting state, some invariants, could I always write down some free Fermion state with the same invariants?
So for this example, yes. For the examples that we consider here, yes. But I think in general that's not the case. And I think there are some examples where you have actually like intrinsically interacting invertible states. I think Chung, you have some examples, right? In 3D, I think.
Sorry.
In 3D, you have some examples where.
Okay.
Well,
there are examples you can cheat on, like you take a bosonic EA.
But I guess I was thinking more of like that in 3D you have TIs that you don't have like a non-interacting realization.
Okay. Yeah, but that's very similar to things here. You can have a usual sector with time regulation.
Now for the questions, that's time.